Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Storybox, where I, your host, Jay Phantom, has the utmost privilege and honor to unbox the amazing stories of some incredible people from all walks of life and experiences. I'm delighted and grateful that you're here today. Now let's dive into the story box and hear more about our guest today. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Story Box podcast. I've actually wanted to release this episode for quite a while now, but really struggled to find a perfect time, if there is such a thing, to actually release it. But with the state of the world right now and everything that is going on in terms of unrest, this false information being publicized. Yes, I said it. There is a lot of false information out there, a lot of clickbait. I felt like my next guest is the perfect man to sort of come on and really shed some light into a lot of these issues that are happening in the world. Now, we actually did this interview a while ago. Dave Rubin is my guest today, in case you were wondering. Dave and I actually did this interview. He was one of the first ones to actually believe in what I was doing, come on the Story Box and really just have an amazing conversation. This was just when he brought out his latest book, Don't Burn This Book. It has since become a New York Times bestseller, selling hundreds of thousands of copies. He's also the founder and host of The Rubin Report over on YouTube and Apple Podcasts. Apple Podcasts, he gets thousands upon thousands, even millions of downloads. And same with YouTube. He's spoken to many high-profile people like Bob Saget, Roseanne Barr, Richard Lewis, politicians like John McCain, Gary Johnson, and thought leaders like Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, Ben Shapiro, religious leaders too, Bishop Barron and Rabbi Wolpe, if I'm saying that correctly, and TV legends like Larry King and John Stossel, and so many others. He's got a very wide and diverse audience. He's able to take information and really break it down to make us all understand what it's really about. And I felt that now, with so much information being put out there into the world, we are really in a epidemic for, or a struggle, I should say as well, for our freedom. And who better to come on and talk about freedoms and liberties and all that than Dave Rubin himself. So I hope you guys really enjoy this one. This is, I'm not too much on the political sense, but we focus more on his story. Then we dive into some of those tougher questions as well. I just thought that it'd be best for everyone to know, really, there's always two sides to every story. Dave and I get to talking all about that on this episode. So I know you guys are going to love it in some way, shape, or form. So with that being said, my friends, please, if you do like this one, subscribe on Apple Podcasts for more. Share it around to your friends and family members that need to hear this episode. Leave a 5-star rating and review over on Apple Podcasts. Your support is greatly appreciated. And let's help build this community of the Storybox. Let's make it bigger. And every single time I release an episode, 1% better, right? That's what I'm aiming for, to reach as many people as I possibly can in the world. So thank you so much, guys. So let's dive into the Story Box and hear Dave Rubin's story.
Thank you. It is good to be with you. It has been quite an adventure. That was quite an intro.
Thank you.
I hope I can live up to all of that good stuff.
I'm sure you can and more. So I am really looking forward to this interview. But before we get stuck into your backstory and why you do what you do, I usually have one question that I love asking people, and that is, what is your definition of success?
That's a great question. It's quite a way to start off an interview. I think success is that you wake up with purpose, that you wake up and you have a day that is filled with things that add meaning to your life. Now, that often is work. But hopefully it also involves your home life and your spouse and maybe your kids or your family or your local community or your friends. But I would say basically success, I don't judge my success now really by monetary success or material things. You know, it's nice. You know, I have a couple bucks now, which is nice. And I have a nice house where we built my studio and all that. But that really isn't what I view success. What I view success is I have purpose every day when I wake up. Mm. And especially right now with the release of this book, it's like I don't have a free minute during the day. But I'm not just doing stuff that I don't want, having conversations like this with people literally all share thoughts on what's going on in my life and what I gives me purpose. And I think through that, I have found success.
Mm, that's a good answer, man. And in terms of this idea or this definition of purpose for you, how can someone find purpose in their own life, do you think?
I mean, it's probably the hardest thing because it's like saying, what's the meaning of life? You know, I believe that finding purpose really is the meaning, that's how you make meaning in your life, that you, if you create a world around you where you are doing something you find valuable, you will surround yourself with people that are probably doing something similar. They may not be doing it at the same level. They may be at a different part of the quest. But I find that the more that I do what I think is right, the more that I say what I actually believe, the more that I've encountered like-minded people. And then that, I think, is actually how we can all sort of repair the world. Mm. So I think the important thing is going out there and doing what you believe and trying it. It doesn't mean you will be successful right off the bat. In most cases, you won't be successful for quite some time. You know, I had a lot of struggling years as a comic and a whole bunch of stuff before this. You know, people always seem like, oh, you're an overnight success. And it's like, well, where were you the other 20 years?
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Like people often look at where you are at this point right now and they kind of forget the journey that led up to you getting to where you are today. So I'm interested in terms of your beginnings, because what I read in the intro was you went from this left mentality or mindset. Was that part of your upbringing and your home life?
Well, you know, I think most people in an American perspective, but I think this broadly throughout a Western perspective, so UK, Australia, I think generally you're sort of brought up with a lefty perspective. So in an American sense, it's kind of like, oh, Democrats good, Republicans bad, liberals care about poor people, conservatives care about money. You know, Democrats are anti-war, Republicans are for war. Like, that's just sort of like the basic factory setting stuff that most of us are sort of almost born with in a way, especially in America. And then the quest, I think, if you want to be a true free-thinking person, is to break free of that factory setting. And I love the phrase factory settings, because it's like when you get a television or you get a computer, it comes with those basic settings that everyone comes with. But then you might want a little more brightness or a little more contrast, or on your computer, your screensaver is going to kick in at a different point. That's sort of what life's about, that we're all sort of given this sort of equal thing. You know, certainly in a Western country sense, it's like in America, if you're born in America, you're free. You're free. There's no laws stopping you from doing whatever you want to do. We're all treated equally. It doesn't mean that we're all going to have success. You may have to work harder. Some people are born in a lot of money. Some people aren't. Some people have great physical gifts. Some people don't. That's all what the challenge of life is, to find your place in the universe. But I think if you're born in the West, you're born free. And I think that a lot of people are sort of born with this factory setting thing that sets them up as a lefty first. And it takes a lot of time to break out of that, because you have to, you know, it's sort of like Neo in the Matrix. It's why the red pill scene is so, so often meme, because it's like, you know, Morpheus, basically says to him, you know, if you want to continue living in a dream and not know what reality is, go ahead and take this blue pill. But if you want to know what reality is, you got to take this red pill. And I think a lot of people are taking the red pill right now, just realizing that a lot of the stuff that they were taught wasn't exactly right. And they're trying to figure out new ways to look at the world.
That's interesting, because in Australia, politics is very different. Like, we have Liberal and we have Labor, which is two different sides of the spectrum. And one side believes one thing and the other side believes another thing. and one side provides more value, whereas, you know, it's more or less like what you believe in what that side does and the leaders and all that sort of stuff. Like, I'm not so heavily focused on politics in the sense like American politics that I'm meaning. So what is this, for those people that don't know, what is this lefty mindset and how can someone break out of it?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked me that because, you know, when I've talked to a couple other Australian podcasters, my dog's very excited right now. I've talked to a couple other Australian podcasters and I've talked to people in the UK and a few other countries. And through that, when I say liberal means something different to you guys in Australia than it means to people in the UK. And it means something different here in America. So when I talk about leftism, let's first talk about leftism, which is socialism, collectivism. The idea basically is that the state is somehow inherently good. Mm. And if we can just give the state enough money, meaning take enough money from some people, that the state will just organize us in a way that will be good. I simply don't believe that is a proper way to govern. It's completely reversed of how the founders of the United States set everything up. They wanted the people to, in effect, be able to govern themselves. They were escaping a king. Mm. What socialism offers, and they do it with a smiley face, they say, oh, you'll have free this, free that. You know, we're going to give you all of this stuff. But what they're not telling you is we have to take your freedom to do that. We have to take your choice away to do that. So when I talk about progressivism or leftism, that's what I'm talking about. Now, a lot of people think that that is liberalism also. And this is where the liberals have sort of failed. So when I talk about liberalism, I'm talking about classical liberalism, which is sort of the Enlightenment era liberalism. That means you believe in individual rights, which is what I described before. Everyone in a society that's legally there should be equal under the law. And then you want the light touch of government. If something can't be solved by the market, solved by private enterprise, you want some government involved, but you don't want the government to have to do everything. Mm. And what has happened is that the progressives sort of saw the liberals, and the liberals are kind of open-minded, and the progressives just came in and they kind of infected the host and basically destroyed liberalism. So when I talk about my version of liberalism, that probably makes more sense to you in Australia as like a libertarian. Mm. Meaning that I don't really want the government to do much of anything. So a classical liberal and a libertarian, in effect, are almost the same thing. I would say a liberal is maybe a little more okay with some state power, where libertarians really want to disassemble as much state power as possible. And then, you know, then on the other side of that, you have conservatives, and conservatives generally, there's usually a religious attachment to it, but not always. There are some secular conservatives. But also conservatives have more of a focus on sort of the time-tested fundamental beliefs, you know, in family and in unity, and to keep away all of the sort of bad ideas that would break those things down. Mm. So conservatives are on the right, libertarians are on the right, I would say classical liberals are at this point on the right. And then really what we're all sort of opposing right now is progressivism. Because if you told me that progressivism was to progress towards equality, meaning equality under the law, well, then I would be a progressive. But progressivism, we've already accomplished equality under the law. Progressives are now trying to progress to a place where they can reorder the whole game. And that I am not interested in. And I find it to be very dangerous.
So in your experience and having spoken to some pretty high profile politicians over the years as well, and in your own opinion, having studied political science as well, do you believe there is I'm not going to say perfect, but a better way to sort of govern and manage the country and the nation rather than just having all of these political parties pop up and say they're the best way? Believe us.
I think we've done it pretty damn well in the United States. Our system itself, the idea that we have three branches of government, the legislative branch, which is supposed to write the laws, the executive branch, that's the president, he's supposed to sign the laws, and the judicial branch is supposed to make sure those laws are legal. That's a pretty great system of checks and balances that really goes out of its way to make sure that no system, no person, no group becomes too powerful. It's not a perfect system, but I would be leery of anyone saying that they could bring about a perfect system. This is what progressives do. They try to tell you, if we were in power, we could fix all of your problems. There'd be no poverty. There would be, you know, we'd fix the environment. We'd fix all these things. And it's just not true. It's not true. We've done, I think, a pretty damn good job of freeing people to live the lives that they want, which is, by the way, why everyone loves America still. Everyone still wants to come to America. Americans don't leave. The only people that leave America are billionaires who are sick of the taxes. But nobody really leaves America. So I don't know that there's a better system. That doesn't mean we can't tweak the system every now and again. That doesn't mean that, you know, right now our Congress, you know, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, they don't really function that well. They don't do much of anything at this point. So I'm a little concerned about that. I would say, you know, a lot of us also, we sort of, it's funny because we left the United Kingdom because of we ruled the king, and yet a lot of people think the president here is the king, as if he's supposed to do everything. But the guy is just one third of the government. That's it. And I know, obviously, around Trump, there's a certain cult of personality to it also. but I would say our system is as close to perfect as you can get. And even for the flaws in our system, I would document the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, that you have God-given rights. The state did not make you free. It can take your freedom, but it didn't make you free. That is some brilliant stuff that I think most people on earth, if they understood what living freely truly is, would love to have those documents.
So do you think we are working towards in America for that? That sense, we are working towards becoming more free and a more freer society?
Well, we're in a struggle for freedom right now. I mean, even what's happening with COVID right now, it's like we're locked in our houses. Yeah, I'm here in California. We're not allowed to go to the beach. In many ways, that is against our Fourth Amendment, which is our right to assembly. But right now, in effect, that has been suspended. So I'm very worried that this is the first time in a long time that, you know, some of our true rights are being eroded away. And that's why I want the states to figure out the best way to open up possible. We cannot live in our houses like we're hamsters in a cage all the time. And that doesn't mean there's not going to be any risk on the other side. Of course there's going to be risk. Is it possible that if we start opening up that some more people are going to get sick suddenly? Of course. But at some point, we have to start living again. We all know we can't do this forever. And the more they just pretend that, oh, we have to wait till nobody's going to get sick, like, that's not an honest way of showing us what the problem is.
It's very interesting, I think, in this time especially, because our rights as human beings as well, in Australia, for that fact, they're being challenged as well. I mean, we're still in lockdown. They've been releasing certain, I guess, restrictions for us, but we're still ultimately meant to be in lockdown. And I was reading the other day this very interesting article about, I think it's 7 steps of a totalitarianism society. Do you believe in your experience and having spoken to so many people regarding politics and freedoms and liberties and all that, that we are heading there?
I think it's very possible that the seeds are being planted for that. Right? Like, we're trapped in our houses, as you just said. Yeah, they're kind of opening up a little bit, and we're seeing some states opening up here, but I'm not open here in my state of California. So I don't mean that to say there's some grand conspiracy, some globalist conspiracy that is trying to enslave all of us. I don't mean it that way, but I do mean that when people are nervous, people that want power have good opportunity to take power. And, you know, it's like this beach thing here in California. Like, I know Australians love a good beach. I was at the beach in Perth, and you guys know how to do beach lifestyle, right? Okay.
Yes.
And the thing is that, you know, here, all they did was say the beaches are closed. They didn't explain anything. They didn't say, hey, instead of closing all the beaches, we're going to put them at half capacity. And when you park your car, you have to make sure your car isn't next to anybody else, and only groups of 4 or less can come. That would have been a mature way to deal with it. But instead, they just say, no, the beach is closed. And that does make me worried that authoritarianism is on the rise, because it's like, why are we just listening to edicts by people? Why do they not explain things to us?
Yeah.
And maybe at some level we've grown very fat. We've grown very fat on our freedoms, and we don't even know when some bad ideas are spreading.
Definitely, man. It's very interesting to see, and I'll be curious to watch what happens in the coming months and possibly years to come. I do want to focus on a little bit about your backstory a little bit. And you said you a stand-up comedian. So did you always want to get into comedy or politics? Which one came first?
I used to be funny in another life. Now I talk about politics all the time. You know, I always wanted to be a comic, actually. From when I was 7 years old, I saw Bill Cosby himself, which was his famous special, which was the dentist routine in there and the chocolate cake routine. And, you know, of course, obviously, when you mention Bill Cosby now, people have other associations, but he was a groundbreaking comic who woke me up to comedy. And then I just fell in love with comedy. I fell in love with comedians from, you know, George Carlin and Richard Lewis and Jerry Seinfeld and now Larry David and all these guys that, you know, being a comedian, a good comic is saying something true. And through saying something true, if you can laugh at it, it's a little bit easier to understand. Mm. So I always said to my friends, it was like, one of us was going to be a comic, because I had a bunch of funny friends. We were always making fun of each other and pointing out absurdities and all that. And I did stand up for about 12 years in New York City. I had some great successes in it. I had the struggle years of being a comic and everything else. And the funny thing for me now is I don't really do stand up anymore, but when I was on tour with Jordan and when I'm traveling throughout the country, if I see that I have a night open, I'll usually book that club. And I, you know, now because I have a following, I can sell out a club. And I don't really do traditional stand up, like what's the deal with, you know, your shoes. I do, like, I just kind of get up there and I wing it and I have fun and I enjoy talking to everybody and I get the crowd going and I give away t-shirts and I get people yelling at each other and do just like a free for all. And it's very different than traditional stand up. But I find it refreshing and nice. And because I don't need it anymore, I can enjoy it in a way that was tough before, because when you need it, it's like when you need anything, you can't fully enjoy it.
Were you the class comic?
You know, I wasn't the class clown, but I was the guy that was kind of next to the class clown getting the secondary laugh. So if the class clown sort of broke up the whole class, I would comment on what he was doing after he did it. That was more of my thing, which actually, I guess, makes sense in retrospect. I mean, I became a talk show host and I knew how to read a room very early on. Yeah.
Mm. So where did the political science come into it? Like, did you get sort of fed up with comedy, or why did you choose politics? Because that's so far away from, in some respects, it's actually quite similar, but it's so, like, in terms of career-wise, they're so polar opposites in a way.
In a certain way, but I was always interested in politics. My family, although nobody was involved in politics directly, my family was always very political in that we would debate all of the topics. All our holidays were, you know, adults sitting around the table, everybody's arguing about everything. And I remember being at the kids' table, always trying to get to the adults' table because I thought whatever they were talking about was interesting, you know, debating anything, foreign policy, abortion, whatever it might be. And then, you know, you'd get heated sometimes and then dessert would be served and we'd stop and it would be just fine. So I think then I went to college and I had that interest. So I was a political science major. And I was just always interested. I was always also interested in news in general. And I always liked doing current events when I was a kid, you know, who, what, when, where, why, how. I always liked doing that kind of stuff. And politics was free. Everyone's political all the time, which I think is a little dangerous, actually, which is also why I try to bring a little sanity to the game, because, you know, a lot of it is very insane. And I think the more, if you're just endlessly political and that's the only joy you get out of life, you have a life of misery ahead of you.
Definitely. That's really good, man. I have one more question. Oh, sorry. A few more questions for you. One is, what was one of the biggest lessons that your father or mother taught you growing up that you still remember to this day?
Well, it's the same lesson, because this is, I think, more than anything else. And I mentioned this at the acknowledgments of the book. My parents have been married like 48 years. We've been in the same house that I grew up in since I was 3 years old. They still live there right now. My sister and her husband and kids are living there with them in the middle of coronavirus. My parents, they taught us family. They taught us about family. You got to be there for family. That's really the most important thing there is. We still get together for holidays whenever we can. I try to host some here. I go back to New York for others. You know, I'm very close with my brother and sister and their spouses. And we've been doing, you know, like everybody else, we've been doing Zoom family dinners and, you know, have a glass of wine and everything else. You know, just the importance of family, because, you know, you can have friends and you can have Twitter buddies and Facebook things and all that. And of course, lifelong friends are wonderful and new friends are great too. I don't mean to dismiss any of that. But there's something about the family. You come from these people, their parents or your grandparents and all of that stuff. It adds to something that is deeply human. And I think we forget that sometimes. And I think, by the way, that people are waking up to it a little bit right now because, you know, it's like, I haven't hugged my mom in over 2 months. I want to hug my mom, you know, and I think a lot of people are thinking that.
Yeah. I was speaking to someone the other day actually about that very thing. They've been doing Zoom meetings and I'm like, how in the world does that work? Like, it's interesting. But when you were, I guess, growing up and you were a comic as well and doing stand-up and you're going through all the challenges, what would you say was your biggest challenge through that and also something that sort of built up your resilience as a result?
Well, it's probably the same thing, which is that you just have to not quit. And I know that sounds kind of like glib or something, but like when you're doing stand up and you're in those struggle years when you're not getting paid and you're trying to figure out what you're doing. And, you know, here in America, we did something called barking, which I'm sure you guys, your comics are doing it too, where you got to stand out on the street corners, handing out tickets, trying to get people to show up, and you might perform for 4 minutes in front of six people and two of the people don't even speak English, and you know, and you're out there and it's miserably cold or it's raining or the rest of it. It's like that's not fun. But what you learn through that is that hard work and dedication pays off. Like when I think back to those, I spent years on these street corners, 6 nights a week, sometimes 2 hours a night doing that in major snowstorms, and no matter what was going on. I was doing it in right after 9/11, which was seriously weird and uncomfortable, and the rest of it. And what I look back on it, and I'm like, I don't know how the hell I did it. How did I do it? Sometimes it would be so cold, I'd put on two pairs of pants and double socks just to stand outside to go do stand up, you know? And I don't know how I did it, but I guess it's sort of that's what life's about. Like when you're young, you just do stuff and know why you're doing it. And then you look back on it one day and you're like, holy cow, I did that. So I think just that work ethic, you got to work hard and it's going to suck. You know, nothing's easy. Nothing that's worthwhile in this world is easy. If it was easy, everyone would do it. You exactly. really want something, you better be prepared to make a lot of sacrifices for that thing.
I'm curious to know, when did this meeting with Jordan Peterson come about, and how did it come about actually?
Yeah, so it was about, well, we first met, it's about 3.5 years ago now. And we first did our first interview was on Google Hangouts, because I was building this studio and hadn't yet. And a lot of people were talking about him on Twitter. And I did this chat with him on video, and our internet wasn't great here and it was very choppy and I could barely see him at times. And we finished the interview and I thought, man, that was either the smartest, most interesting person I've ever spoke to, or he's a complete nut. And then over the course of the next 2 years, you know, I got to know Jordan quite well. We had him on the show in here many times. We toured together for a year and a half. And what I saw was a guy who was honestly fighting for what he believed in, who was writing things that were true, who was helping people turn their lives around. You know, the 10 days or so that we spent in Australia, was some of the best parts of the tour that we had. I absolutely loved Australians. I loved the country. You know, got to hang out with the koala, did all of that kind of stuff. You know, what I love though about Australians is you guys have a great sense of humor. Also, there's very big similarities with Americans. You guys don't like political correctness. And you know, to do the last thing that Jordan and I did together was the Sydney Opera House. And it was our only matinee show of the whole tour. It was a beautiful day. And I'm sure you've been there, and it's, you know, all the people outside and it's gorgeous and the theater is incredible. And I didn't know that the Opera House actually is a theater in the round, meaning there's audience completely surrounding you. You know, most theaters, you're just looking out to the audience, but in this, you have audience in front of you. You got audience on the sides and behind you. And as a comic, to go up there and get a laugh, when you get a laugh, and you feel the laughter hitting you from behind, hitting you from the side, because you can actually feel it because it there's a sound to it and you can physically feel it. It's like, that was absolutely awesome. So truly one of my best memories of the entire tour was that final show that we did in Sydney.
Well, I am biased because I am Australian and I love my own country, but I also love Americans. And I've been told a lot that Australians actually look up to Americans, and it's a complete opposite as well for you guys. You kind of love Australians. It's like, it's funny. Like we're kind of, yeah. I'm curious to know.
I think Americans see Australians in many cases as kind of like a slightly more fun version of us.
Yeah.
Or something like that. You know, like you guys are a little more chill. I mean, one of the things that I didn't know about Australia is I guess you guys have notoriously bad service at restaurants. That like, it's just like, yeah, if the waitress shows up, she shows up. If you get your food, you get your food. If it's the wrong order, you just eat it.
Yeah.
You know, like there's just like a more relaxed atmosphere there. Maybe that's because you guys are an island, you know, you've got water around you. Things are a little bit easier. We got to deal with Canada, you know?
You got to come back here. And when you do come back here, I'll take you to all the great restaurants and I mean, cafes that I know, because I know the owners, and you don't have to wait too long for your service. And if you get it,
I will gladly take you up on that. We're definitely going to do.
Sorry,
you up on that. We're going to do an Australian tour for sure.
Awesome.
When things get back to normal.
Awesome. So I'm curious to know as well, like you've been around Jordan Peterson for a long period of time. What was one thing that you took away from Jordan that you've never taken away from anyone else?
That if you truly say what you believe, and if what you believe is good and just and right, you can change the world.
Mm.
You know, it's like, I know a lot of people think he was like Superman or something, or like he's almost not human what he did, but I know that the man was human. I spent a lot of time with him off camera, off stage, being a regular guy, taking a walk, going to lunch, you know, like taking a car ride on the road. And he's a regular man, I assure you of that. And what he tried to do was write something true, which is what he did with 12 Rules. And then he tried to apply that to the world. And by doing that, he actually changed the world.
Mm.
And I think anyone is capable of doing that. I really do.
Mm, definitely. So, Dave, I want to talk to you about your new book for a moment and give you a chance to sort of publicize it and tell people about it a little bit more and why they should buy it. So what is Don't Burn This Book? What inspired you to write it? And why do people need to read it?
Well, what is Don't Burn This Book? Look, this is what I think about everything. These are, I think what I lay out in this book are time-tested, generationally churned, common sense ideas on how people can live freely. And then not only that, I blend it with some of my own personal story about my political evolution, about a bit, and how people can start fighting for what they believe. The purpose of the book is not to convince you that I'm right about everything. The purpose of the book is to, my mic went crazy there for a sec. The purpose of the book is not to get you to agree with me on everything. The purpose is to get you to think for yourself. If you read this book and you go, man, Dave is really off on, you know, those two or three things, but I'm going to think about them and I'll send him a tweet about it. It's like, that is just great. So I want to show people you can stand up to the mob. You should fight for free speech. You should say, I can have all sorts of thoughts and I don't have to say I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican or whatever, that you can come up with a cohesive set of views that will enrich your life. And why did I write it? Because I believe in that. And I think the world is in a strange place where people aren't that sure what they believe. And I wanted to help give them the courage to do that.
Mm, that's good. Where can people buy the book?
Well, I believe that our Australian publisher is through the UK. So I think you guys have to go to the UK Amazon site.
Okay.
But probably even easier, if you just go to don'tburnthisbook.com. One of the links there will take you to some place that you can get it in Australia. And I know we're doing pretty well out there, but Amazon's probably the best spot.
I'll make sure that the links are all in the bio when this does come out. So I have two more questions for you, Dave, if you don't mind. And second last question is, what is your favorite film, your favorite actor, and the last movie that you watched?
Ha! My favorite film, favorite film, like if I just had to watch something tonight, Total Recall, the original Schwarzenegger movie.
Yes.
You know, I think it's 1987 or 1988, 89. It is just a perfect 80s movie. It's a brilliant sci-fi story written by Philip K. Dick, who wrote a million other great sci-fi stories. And it's just, it's technologically, it was cutting edge for its time. The music is great. Sharon Stone is in it. I love dystopian future kind of stuff. So yeah, I'd say Total Recall, just perfect. My favorite actor. Wow. I've been asked a lot of questions in the last week. Nobody has asked me my favorite actor. My favorite actor. Man.
I love this question.
Yeah, this is good. This it gets is good. I'm really trying to come up. I'm trying to come up with somebody that I really just consistently like. Like I see their stuff and I consistently like them.
Who do you resonate with the most?
You know, I don't know that I have an answer for this. It's like I could just come up with the name of an actor that I like, but I don't know that I'll tell you something that I'm watching right now that I'm absolutely loving. I'm watching The Sopranos. I'm rewatching it. I watched it, you know, 15 years ago. Rewatching it right now, I'm in the midst of season 5, and it's just absolutely, absolutely brilliant. And it's nice to watch things that aren't about the time that we're in right now. It's nice to watch things that are a little bit time capsule themselves.
Just get your brain away from everything, out of normality, so to speak, and just associate yourself with entertainment, just purely mind-numbing stuff. So, Dave,
we need it sometimes.
Yeah, we do. We really do. So my last question for you, Dave, is you've reached 100 years old, and as a birthday present, your friends have put together a mixtape of everything that you've said and everything you've ever done, and they've played it for you. What do you want that mixtape to say and to show?
Well, I hope that it'll show that I was somebody that honestly fought for what I believe in, and that the ideas that I put forth, hopefully in 100 years from now, hopefully those ideas will have taken root even stronger. Hopefully we won't live in a totalitarian dystopian sci-fi future. Hopefully we'll live in a whatever country it is that we live in. Hopefully our countries are freer. Our people are free to say what they think and fight for what they believe in and everything else. And that people will look at that, you know, 80 years of work that I put out there publicly and said, you know, this guy was one of the people that tried his best in a weird time.
That's really good, man. And I feel like that is a perfect way to end our conversation. Dave Rubin, thank you so much for your time, my friend. Really appreciate it. And for coming on the Storybox podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you, and I'm going to take you up on those restaurants when I get back out to Australia.
I'll put it in my calendar, man. Just like literally reach out whenever you want and I'll take you. I know people.
All right.
Thanks, Dave.
Sounds good,
appreciate
man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
I don't like this part because it means that sadly we have come to an end of yet another incredible story. I just want to say thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening to our guest today. It is my prayer that you would have felt inspired, motivated, challenged in some way, and that you would have learned something new as well. If you'd like to hear more amazing stories like this one, you can do so now by searching up The Storybox on any podcast platform. It's that easy. If you did get something from our guest today, please share it around to a friend or family member that you think could benefit from hearing this powerful story. And before you go, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It will only take 30 seconds and it'll go towards reaching more people. Let's start changing lives through powerful stories like this one. Your support is greatly appreciated. Until next time, when we dive back into the story box, I'm Jay Phantom, and don't forget, your story is worth more than you know. I'll catch you next time.